Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you mages, sages, and seers with Setna of Kemet. Greetings and welcome, Setna. How are you, sir?
Hello, Hercules. Hello, everyone. I'm wonderful. I think this year is becoming beautiful, and I think that it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful, great year. I started out well, beautiful weather and positive energy. And that's what I'm seeing for all. So I'm very glad.
I'm seeing that as well, that there seem to be a lot of new opportunities, a lot of old opportunities that were frozen because of the pandemic or some other reason all of a sudden coming into being. So I'm very optimistic about the new year as well.
And I'm putting it out there. If someone needs me, let me know. I shall be right there for you. So mote it be.
So mote it be. That's very generous of you. I'm really looking forward to tonight's topic. It's very esoteric and very deep.
I wanted to compare our two cultures, the Greeks and the Egyptians. I wanted to have to show that although they're quite different, they're also quite similar in certain other ways. So, for instance, let's talk about mysteries and mysterious things and dreams. In your culture, in Greek culture, those are ruled over by a being called hypnos. Dreams, visions, omens, all of these things were brought about by hypnos. He worked with Apollo at Delphi with Pythia, and I know those energies quite well. Well, in Egypt, we have Nephthys. She is the queen of shadows. She is invisible to mortals, but she is the identical twin to Isis. Aset, the wife of Osiris, the goddess of mystery and enchantments and magic. Nephthys is equal to her sister, but she takes a darker side. She's invisible. She comes when you can see visions of her, but she's not visible to mortals on purpose. Hypnos is the same way. I don't think any mortal ever saw hypnos. How do you feel about that, Hercules? Do you have any thoughts?
Well, hypnos, I work with dreams. I've worked with dreams since I was a very young child. So I have bins of notebooks of my dreams. Hypnos is always portrayed veiled in shadow, like you often seen in a room that's a dark room where he's with his wife, and he has a twin brother called Thanatos, which means death. And in Greece to this day, Thanatos is one of the spirits that takes people from this life into the underworld or the other world.
The angel of death in such a way. In Egypt, that's Anubis. You see, there are correlations there.
Yeah.
This is what I'm telling you. Thanatos and Anubis are kin. Anubis is a tall black creature that has the head of a jackal and the body of a dark man, usually seen in a copper armband and a copper collar and a reddish copper kilt, Egyptian-looking kilt, carrying a wash staff and a sword, Egyptian hooked sword, as you know. And he is called also one of the people that is called Opener of the Ways. He will take and open through the path of life into the tunnel, like we see the light going into the land of the dead. Anubis will be holding your hand and carrying that way. Thanatos, I'm told, is much the same. So we have two creatures already, Nephthys of mystery, who is very much like Hypnos, and Thanatos and Anubis are also very much alike. And that's what I'm seeing, that the Greeks and the Egyptians were very much in accord with their spiritual energies and their deity forces.
Well, there's a story in Greek mythology that when Typhon was leading his invasion, he and his forces managed to storm Olympus, and the gods fled to other countries, including Egypt. And in Egypt, they assumed animal guises. And there was a list of which animals were which god. So the Greeks in antiquity certainly believed that there was a correspondence between the Greek and Egyptian divinities.
Exactly. And Typhon, they have a lot of similarities. They call there's an Egyptian god called Subek or Sobek, who was a crocodile headed. And he is also Typhon. Some people brought or likened Typhon in or Typhon or Subek to the Christian Jewish devil, Hebrew devil. He is a mischief maker. He's a troublemaker, but was worshipped also as a deity, as Set and Sekhmet were, as a deity of healing. But the crocodile could send away negative energy by absorbing it and bringing it into the water and destroying it. It's many, many temples in Egypt had pet crocodiles. I don't know what they fed, don't want to know, but they had pet, the crocodiles became quite domesticated. I don't think they had them, you know, as pets in the house, but they were pets in the temple. They would come up off out of the pool, and they recognized certain, obviously, priests and priestesses, and they would, you know, accept, I guess, you know, pieces of meat or what have you, or a slave or two, unfortunately, to, you know, give homage to the god Typhon, the god Sobek, who is also associated with protector of the Nile. You have, I guess, in a lot of ways, God in Greece would then mimic or be part or equal to Typhon.
Typhon in the Hellenic mythology was the husband of Echidna. And Echidna is called the mother of monsters.
And yes, I know. Echidna reminds me of the Morrigan.
Yes. And many of the fabulous creatures or monsters that were encountered by the heroes and even the gods were the children of Typhon and Echidna.
So would that be like the Hydra?
Yeah, the Hydra, the Stymphalian birds, and the man-lion. I don't remember all of them, but there were quite a few.
And all that too.
Yeah, there was some speculation that, basically Hercules killed a lot of the children of Typhon and Echidna during his labors, and the Hercules TV show, when that was on, poked fun at that a few times.
Yes, I remember Kevin Sorbo attack Echidna from time to time, and she coming back in various episodes to get back at him. They also were not very kind. They were not very kind to Hera. They made her a complete villainess.
Yes.
I'm sure she was raging on Olympus when she, you know, was watching on her celestial TV, and she was like, just a minute here. I am the goddess. I am the wife of Zeus. How dare you? You know, and I mean, he's Hercules. He's got his name. He's got her name. His name. He's got her name in Hera. Yeah.
Yeah, his name is Warrior Hera.
Yeah.
And in some versions of the myth, like in the Etruscan version of the myth, Hera is his actual mother, and she's not trying to kill him. They're on friendly terms, actually. So there were different variations of the Greco-Roman myths all around the Mediterranean, and in some, the relationships are quite different. In the Etruscan, Hercules and Athena are married, and their child is Ares, or Martus.
Ah, well, just as that happened, marries Osiris. She becomes the second wife. Isis does not object. Isis gives birth to Horus. Nephthys gave birth to Anubis. He is her guardian son, as Horus guards his mother Isis. So it's kind of interesting that way. You've got Anubis who can transmit transition, I guess you'd say, both worlds, both the living and the dead, and other regions, other energies, other dimensions. Anubis is a time traveler and a space shifter, a shapeshifter, and that's kind of interesting. I was going to also bring up, everyone knows that Athena in Greece is the goddess of two things, which are strange kind of contradictions. She's a goddess of knowledge and wisdom, but she's also the goddess of war.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wondered if big war is a very intelligent thing, but here you've got this amazing, beautiful, powerful goddess who's also the goddess of all wisdom and all knowledge. And in Egypt, it's the same thing. The god, Tehute, both the Ibis god, who is the king, creator of all scribes and alphabets and languages, also, they say, created battle plans for the gods to help them win with Ramses II, Thutmosis III, even Hatshepsut. Many, many pharaohs owe their battle plans to Thoth. And I know that, you know, Pericles attributed Athena's magic and energy to his success. Here we've got two things that have happened. All the pharaohs, including Seti, Ramses II's, I guess, grandfather, all owe this knowledge to Thoth. And I know that the Greek heroes, if they have a battle plan of war, I think even in the Odyssey and the Iliad, they know that Athena is going to help them put together, you know, battle plans and work on things that way. Hera, we know, if you think about Ray Harryhausen, helped Jason, did she not, in the guise of the actress Anna Blackman. She was very famous for that part, but we do know what Anna Blackman was more famous for. She was in Goldfinger, in James Bond. I hope we don't get bleeped. Her name in Goldfinger was Pussy Galore.
I remember that.
She was beautiful. She kind of looked like Anne Francis, the beautiful blonde golden mane, big, big blue eyes, a beautiful face, a great figure. Athena is also supposed to be, and she fought, after all, with her sisters over who was the most beautiful, did she not?
Yes.
Which caused the Trojan War. They were going to give Paris the golden apple. And, you know, all three of the goddesses, it was Aphrodite, Athena, and who was the third one, Hercules?
Hera.
And they were all furious.
Hera, yes.
Yeah, well, they were furious. I think he chose Aphrodite, didn't he?
He chose Aphrodite, and basically Paris, was actually Alexander, his name was, and he was the son of Priam, who was the king. But there was a prophecy when he was born that he would bring destruction to Troy. So they left him out, you know, they exposed him to the elements. But a sheep herder, you know, came across him, or some say was assigned to leave him out for the animals, and took pity on him. So he took him home and raised him as his own son. And so he had this royal lineage that he wasn't aware of. And on an esoteric level, he was, you know, basically being asked to choose his path. Would he choose wisdom? Would he choose the way of power? Or would he choose the way of love? And of course, being a young man, he chose the way of love. But the gods and goddesses of antiquity, their stories show us what happens under certain circumstances. They don't necessarily tell us what to do. They'll sometimes tell us what not to do or what will happen if you do something. So that whole story is one of those instructional tales.
Well, a very similar tale comes from my name, Comwes. There was I guess he's a reincarnation of mine. His name is Prince Setna Comwes. He was from which I devised my name. And according to people that have done past life regressions with me, that is me. And when I saw in the Brooklyn Museum his stele, I was dumbfounded. And they've just, I don't want to look at it, but they just found his mummy. And it's kind of disconcerting to me, you know.
I can imagine.
Saw the movie, well, if you ever saw the movie Warlock, the hero.
I remember that movie, yes.
He's forced, the hero is forced to take a book out of his hands. His girlfriend at the time, who comes back from this century, who's Laurie Singer, who was more known for Footloose and also the TV show Fame, breaks her fingers and takes out this magical pages. Anyway, Conwes has a similar situation. He has a beautiful, beautiful wife whose name is Marici. And she dies. And she comes back to life as a shade, a spirit, and can inhabit physical forms. He makes for her a wax image, a life-size wax statue, and she brings it to life. And in order for him to keep that woman as a human being, he has to find the Book of Ra. And somewhere along the line, he comes out of that wax body and walks through a temple that no one's been in for centuries. And she is confronted by Tehute Thoth, which is where I'm getting to with this. And he says to her, there is a scroll that will bring you back to life and bring you back to Conwes. But there is a very, very harsh, if you tell him why and how you're back to life. It's kind of like Orpheus and Eurydice this way, because Marici comes back to life with him and she bears him two children, a son and a daughter. And she cannot tell him. She refuses or is afraid to tell him how she came back to life. And somewhere along the line, she's talking to a beautiful maid of hers. And Conwes is in the next room and he overhears her. And he finds the scroll that she's telling this maid about, which she had no business telling. Tehute gets so angry with all of them that she turns into a stone image of herself. The children are turned into sparrows and they fly away. And Conwes opens the container of the scroll and disintegrates, disappears from view. Now, some people say that scroll, and we don't know this because we know the Egyptians were very advanced in technology, they say that scroll was probably a nuclear pylon.
Oh, wow.
That he opened
up
ceramic bottle and the tube, and the ceramic bottle or tube probably had radioactive material in it, and it made him, dissolve or disintegrate. But he was never seen again, and they say that the tube somehow miraculously disappeared also, which is probably China syndrome. Probably just burned itself into the earth. But she vanished, and the children vanished, and he vanished. He's the only, but somewhere along the line, he must have come back because he does have a tomb. He does have mummy case, and they did find him. They never found Marici, and they never found the children. So Tehute, for all his wisdom and knowledge, did also have a temper. He did know that when you break a promise, that's the moral, I'm sure. When you break a promise, that there is consequences.
Yeah, the myths are very instructional, and fortunately, the early psychologists like Freud and Jung, they mined the myths very heavily. They came to different conclusions, but they did mine the myths. And the golden age of that type of study was with the transpersonalists, sometimes called neo-Jungians. They visited the world mythologies found all this wisdom and pointed it out to us or shined a light on it.
Now, just as the Greek gods and goddesses, the Olympians, are having a resurgence, primarily from what I'm told in Delphi and in Athens. Now, you can back me up or you have more knowledge in that than I do. So, too, is it happening in Alexandria and also down in Luxor, Karnak, in Egypt. The Muslims are a little upset because there are people that are following the ancient Neteru, the gods and goddesses of Egypt, more faithfully again, and they're moving away from the Muslims. It's becoming a revolution thing. People are being killed, I'm afraid. I've been told by people I know in Alexandria that is the penalty for this is death. And
in Greece, there's no death penalty, but they're tying them up in other ways. They're, for instance, the land where the ancient temples are, the permissions are being granted for people to graze their sheep or you know, their cattle at these old structures, but they're not giving permission to the people who follow the old ways to hold their ceremonies at the ancient temple. So the things like that. There are classifications for religions, and I believe that the classification for the old religion is more like a social club or something. They're not giving them full religious status. I haven't kept up with what's going on there. My journeys took me elsewhere. But I know that those were some of the problems maybe 2-3 decades ago when I was closely following what was going on.
I heard about this in Egypt about 30 years ago. The people are what was primarily in Alexandria, which of course we know in relatively older late kingdom, new kingdom and then late kingdom times. Was the seat of all knowledge in Egypt. Alexandria had that incredibly famous library, which was destroyed several times, unfortunately. But the people that follow the gods and goddesses of Egypt are called Pharaoni. There is here in this country Kemetic people, which I'm one of, who follow the gods and goddesses of Egypt and the Neteru. But in Egypt, they're called Pharaoni. And they are basically Ptolemaic, Greek, Greco-Egyptian. So that's kind of a bridge between you and I, Hercules. They follow Zeus Apollo. Zeus Amon, Horus Apollo, Isis Aphrodite. So these are, mixers. But they also follow the pure energy, the pure forms of the Egyptian deities that were gone long before Alexander the Great had that's put on the Egyptian soil. The last pharaoh, native pharaoh, to follow those things, basically had kind of a leftover view of them. They weren't really, because he was Persian and Egyptian, his name was Nectanebus or Nectanebo. When he heard that Alexander was coming, he shaved off his little beard, he shaved his head, and he ran to Pella, to Mesopotamia, to Macedonia, to be a servant there for the god, for the queen Olympia, who of course was Alexander's mom. So that's kind of interesting. There is also a legend that Alexander's mother had an affair with Nectanebus, and that Alexander really had royal Egyptian blood in him too, and that Philip was not his father. And Philip, all his life, always suspected that that was true. If you see that crazy movie with Angelina Jolie Colin Farrell, she says, Zeus is your father, and she goes on and on and on, and he doesn't look anything like Philip of Macedonia or her. So, there was suspicion that she had an affair with somebody. Philip had many, many affairs, as you know. The last wife of him was named Cleopatra. And when he died, Olympia had she and her child killed, as you know. And then Alexander ruled for, 11 or 12 years or so before he himself was...
He died very young, and he accomplished a great deal during his brief life.
He was 32. I know that from Julius Caesar's writings, that Alexander was 32. Some say he died of malaria. Others say he died of poison, just as they know they killed his friend and or lover, Hephaestus, with poison or something, as they were leaving India. As you know, they had a miserable time in India. They didn't do well. And they were coming back to Persia on their way back to Pella. When first Hephaestion died, and then not too long after, Alexander also passed away. And he's buried because Ptolemy became the next ruler. Ptolemy took Alexander's body to Alexandria in Egypt, where they say it still is somewhere. And that's kind of exciting. But to go back to the gods and goddesses, in that period, which became the Alexandrian, the Ptolemaic period, we have a mixture of Greek and Egyptian marrying itself perfectly. The mythologies overlapped each other very, very well. So when the people like Balzoni and Champollion started to, you know more about the hieroglyphs and know more about the stories, there was a mixture there. It was very hard to pull what was Greek and what was Egyptian apart. And I, in my own research over these, can I scare you, over these 45 years or so, almost 50 years, it's more really, I have seen the separation of the two. I have seen what goes on as far as what is pure Greek and what is pure Egyptian, and then the bringing together of both. And I'm not uncomfortable with the marriage of the two. I find it like East and West, North and South joining together. And it seems to be a very good, well, Cleopatra said it, one nation, one people on earth living in peace. And I think that was what they were trying to do, is have one culture that was a mixture of all the cultures in peace. And that would be a good thing, a wonderful thing, I think, if we could all kind of get that, like they said in the 70s and 80s,
all just get along.
Yeah. Can't we all just get along? And that would be wonderful. The gods and goddesses in Egypt, just as the gods and goddesses in Rome and Greece, didn't always do that, did they? They were always kind of jealous or nudging or fighting or arguing or bickering, all of them. Many, many times they would be, you know, showing themselves all too human sometimes. Osiris was murdered by Set, who was jealous of Osiris's success as a ruler. But after all, Osiris had the Nile. Set had Libya. He had the desert. So you can't really raise crops in the desert. You can't do too much, you know, even with agriculture. How do you graze sheep on cactus and sand and dirt? He didn't plan well. He should have made people fishermen closer to the Mediterranean. But Set didn't look at it that way. Set, like Abel and Cain, Set became jealous of Osiris and plotted to kill him. And is there not also a story like that in Greece? Don't you have gods fighting over each other?
There are many tales in Greek mythology, and the gods are dynasties or generations. You could look at them. Initially, there were the primordials. There was night and love and, you know, dawn and things like that. Then there were the titans, who were the next generation of god, and they defeated the primordials. And then you had the Olympians, which were the third generation of gods, and they defeated the titans. And in each of these successive waves of divinity, some of the old regimes sided with the new regime and became part of the pantheon. So there were attempts against Zeus's kingship where they tried to depose him. And there was always something going on. There was always a lot of divine drama. And the Greeks invented drama. So it was very much there. But you're right. The Hellenic gods are very human. We are their children, or their creations, if you like, or them is one way of looking at it. I've come to believe that we're the dream figures of the gods, and that our human drama that we play out here is but an echo in the myths, or an echo of the myths, actually.
I think that it's very important that we have those energies in the midst and things going on so that we know guidelines. We learn from their good things that they've done and their mistakes.
And the mistakes, I think it's as well, yes.
Well, the gods of the Greeks and the gods of the Egyptians show us just how human we are. And I find that marvelous. I do. Look at, you know, it's not always do as we say or do as we do. It's don't do as we've done.
Right, correct.
Look what we did wrong, look what we did right. And that's true, you know, and it carries over into the Christian, Muslim, and Jewish worlds in the same way. You have, I guess, the advocate, the devil, Lucifer, and you have the divine God. You know, and there, but it, if you go back, way back in the Talmud, in the old ancient scriptures, there is not a devil. He is basically a questioner. The devil becomes the advocate, they call him. He sits on the left side of God and says, okay, this is what's going on over here. What if we make it go this way instead of going that way? And God goes, good point. Let's try that. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And I find that true also of Hermes, Mercury, and Tehute and Ra. And it's similar that way. Both Tehute will say to Ra, you know, we're doing things over here that maybe are not the best way to do things. And let's kind of make certain things happen. And I know Mercury, Hermes, depending on what dynasty or tradition you're working with, will say, Zeus, I'm going to show you something. I was traveling around the world and I saw this. And what are we going to do about this? And I know there are many stories like that. And again, I'm going to go back to good old Ray Harryhausen. Hermes brings Jason to Olympus. And he's standing there before Zeus and Hera and all the other deities as a chess piece, basically. And they're saying, okay, this one doesn't want the gods' help. What's going on here? And what are we? And I always thought they're saying, why don't you want our help? We're the gods. We're the ones that created you. What's going on here? And the same thing happened in Egypt. There is a man. His name is Wa. He's a high priest. And his wife is a chantress. And she is, I think her name was Neh, N-E-H, Neh. And it seems that they were not doing things the way Ra wanted. And a falcon came down from the top of a temple, just as Zeus sometimes appeared as an eagle or what have you, a stream of gold or a mist,
right,
or falcon or a thousand things. And this bird came down and said, I am Ra. I want you to change the way you're doing things here, or things are going to get bad for you. And they didn't listen. And all of a sudden, his wife found another man. He got sick. This story goes on and on, and the man loses everything. In the Hebrew and Christian Bible, this is the story of Job. The man,
yeah,
who loses everything to gain everything. And I know that's also a story. If you think about Oedipus in Greece,
mm-hmm,
he loses everything. He gains, he becomes the king, Oedipus Rex.
Yes.
So, you know, but he sleeps with his mother, he kills his father, and he has a terrible time, and then all of a sudden it kind of sort of works out in the end. But all of your stories end up with everybody dead anyway. Shakespeare did the same thing. They kill everybody. It's hideous.
With Oedipus, just like with Paris, a.k.a. Alexander, he was the royal child. He was the son of Jocasta, and I'm drawing a blank with his father, but they were the rulers of Thebes. And it was prophesied when he was born that he would kill his father and marry his mother. So they went and, of course, put him out in the elements, and somebody took pity and raised him. So he was raised without the knowledge, and he was going towards Thebes, and he was walking, and the king and his chariot were coming, and they kind of pushed him aside, and he had issue with it, so he killed the king. And then on his way to Thebes, he solved the riddle of the Sphinx and was awarded kingship, so he married his mother. So he didn't know that this was his fate, because the person who raised him didn't know, and he didn't know that this was his father or that his road would take him to his mother, but it did. And a lot of the Greek myths show you that you can't escape a prophecy, that no matter what you do, you know, prophecy will win in the end. The same thing with Perseus. Perseus's mother, Danae, her father, to prevent her having a child that will kill him, put her in a chest and threw her out to sea. And
right.
He figured if the gods want to protect her, then they can. So he didn't kill her. He just threw her out to sea in a box. So he felt that he wasn't trying to thwart the will of the gods. And then, too, Perseus was many years later was competing in an athletic contest, and the discus he threw killed his grandfather, but he didn't know that it was his grandfather, but he was destined to kill him, and he did.
Yeah, and his father, if you go back again to good old Ray Harryhausen, the father, the Zeus got very angry. Sir Laurence Olivier blew a head gasket,
yeah.
Destroyed everyone in that city. And then, you know, later on, he went to, what was the city where he meets Cassiopeia and and Andromeda?
Ethiopia.
Yeah, they come and, you know, it just becomes a very crazy thing. She has all those dreams of a lover, which is Perseus, only she doesn't know that. And she was at one time in love with Thetis's son, who was turned into a monster. And that whole thing is an amazing, amazing story, and many, many layered. And the Egyptians like that also. Many of their stories have many, many layers to them, because what would happen is that, you know, a story was told in one dynasty, maybe. They said that Amun-Ra did it in this particular dynasty. Well, the next dynasty, the next group of pharaohs might be from a different state or a different country. And they would say, no, 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 that wasn't Amun-Ra. That was Osiris. Or no, 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 that was Ptah. Or it was Thoth. It changed as the kings changed. And
yes.
I know this is the same true in Greece.
Yes,
but you have real kings, like Agamemnon and his wife Clytemnestra, and they were real people. And their daughter, of course, was Electra. And many, many other kings and queens like that. We know many things going on in Egypt before Akhenaten and Nefertiti, and they had their own decision. They destroyed. They were like Ragnarok to the Vikings. They destroyed all the gods and goddesses by destroying the temples. And then the people of Egypt could take just so much, and then they killed both of them and took back the country. And the gods returned. Surprise, surprise, surprise. My question was, had they ever left? And I think no. Akhenaten ruled 15 years. I think it was enough time for the people, for the Egyptian deities to say to these people, okay, you want to live without us? Look what you've got. Well, we have a king who's a tyrant whose only interest is in himself and his beautiful wife. Is that what you want? Or do you want to be a world power? And do you want to work with the rest of the earth and be, you know, a participant instead of being a victim? And I think what happened under Horemheb and Ramesses, Ramosa, the first Ramses, and the high priest Ie, was they took it back. They made the country whole again, and Egypt became, with Ramses, two 75 years later, had a golden age. It was never so successful, never so prosperous, and everybody in the whole universe at that time, in that whole area, remembers one pharaoh. Ramses mm-hmm. the Great, Ramses II. He is the most recognized, most well-known of all the pharaohs. Of course, in the 20th century, somebody usurped him, a little tiny little king who was unknown to everybody named Tutankhamun, became a superstar 4,000 years after he died. They uncovered his tomb and bingo, instant superstardom. It said in the scrolls that were found of him that he would be famous, more famous than anyone in the world for millions and millions of years. And I can't think of anyone who just never heard of King Tut.
Right, right. King Tut became a sensation.
Yeah. 4,000 years later. I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't know if his press agents told him that, you know, well, buddy, you have to wait 4,000 years, but, you know, you're going to be a real star. And right now he's, you know, in a museum in Manhattan, I think, and they're all excited about him. I don't know that he's actually there, but his treasures are. And
yeah.
That brings me to another.
Okay.
Go ahead, Andre.
No, go ahead. I was just remembering, who was it? Steve Martin did a song, King Tut?
Oh, he sure did. You know, and we had the, what was it, the Bangles that walked like an Egyptian?
Yes.
But King Tut, that was 1977, I think it was. I went to the exhibit in the Metropolitan Museum 3 times.
Oh, right, yeah.
I was a member. I went with my friend Yvonne and Denise and my sister and their 2 sisters. And we had a grand old time, and then I went by myself. I wanted to stand there and look at those pieces without interruption of my friends. I love my friends. I love them dearly still. They're still my friends, you know, 40-odd years later. But I wanted to look into the face of Selkett. I wanted to look at King Tut myself and just say, wow, you know, and remember that time. And I do. I was probably connected or perhaps was the high priest Ai. I remember in a vision with Horemheb sitting there with this 9-year-old boy who's trembling on this little gold altar throne. And we were saying, see here, you little bastard.
Mm.
Your father screwed up the whole world, screwed up everything we did. We're not going to put you on the throne and let you say anything. You're going to do what we tell you to. Do you hear me? And I believe I actually did that. I believe my soul is connected to I, the high. When I saw his signet rings, and they're in the Metropolitan Museum, 2 gold rings that bear his name, I, and it's I as the Grand Vizier and I as the High Priest. And it seems in the Middle East, and later on, and we talked about this Tuesday, the Arabian Nights, the Grand Vizier is always the evil wizard. And it seems like has got reputation too. The High Priest I was High Priest Grand Vizier to 4 pharaohs. Amenhotep III, Akhenaten's father, and Akhenaten was Amenhotep IV. Before him, Amenhotep II, and then Thutmosis, his grandfather. So this man was quite old when he passed away. He was pharaoh after Horemheb, and he was pharaoh before Horemheb. I'm getting backwards here. He was pharaoh for about 10 years, maybe as short as 7, where, you know, the hieroglyphs are a little odd there. He married Ankhesenamen, King Tut's wife. She wrote to different kings saying, help, help, I don't want to marry this guy. Send me one of your sons. And the Hittite king sent a prince to become pharaoh, and he never made it. Somewhere along the line, I got hold of the information and had the poor prince killed in the desert somewhere. They never found him.
That seems to be a common theme about not being found, family disappearing.
Oh, yeah.
They used to erase people's names from monuments and records, too, to make sure that they were really gone. They wouldn't be remembered. They couldn't be identified.
There's a song in the play Nefertiti, which is Andrew Lloyd Webber, very, very seldom done play, but they show the bust, that famous bust that was found not far from Armana, and the song is No One Will Remember. No One Will Remember. And, mm-hmm. you know, the two queens I can think of that mean most about Egypt are Nefertiti and Cleopatra. By the way, neither of them is Egyptian.
No. Nefertiti. Cleopatra, I knew about, but I wasn't sure about Nefertiti.
It's been proved Nefertiti is either Hittite or Mitanni. She's from an eastern province, and that's what it says on various things in Thebes, at the temple of Karnak, that she was a princess of an eastern province, and she was probably originally part of Amenhotep III, Akhenaten's father's harem, and she was a present probably for his 15th birthday. And so was her sister, whose name is Majumene. They both came together, and, you know, they were basically concubines. And it was not uncommon for a pharaoh to take one of his many, many wives and give it to his son, a younger concubine. Here, try this one out. Apparently, he tried her out and made her his queen. And she is, if you've seen the sculpture, one of the most beautiful women you'll have ever seen in your life. Right now, she's in Berlin Museum. I slipped. I don't know. So, yeah, she and there's a bust of Cleopatra, which is actually in my kitchen window, which are originals that are in the Berlin Museum that Egypt is trying to get them back. After all, Nefertiti is on their coinage and their stamps. And their money, their dollars, Egyptian pound, has Nefertiti on it. And they're like, what do you mean she's in Germany? You know, she should be enjoying palm wine, you know, not Wiener Schnitzel. So they're going back, and I do this, I trail off, I know. But going back to the mythologies, there's also, you have in Greece, you have fauns and satyrs and little yeah. funny dwarves that do all kinds of things. Well, in Egypt, there was a god. He is the god of childbirth and jewelry making, which is really strange to do both of those. He kind of looks like an Oompa Loompa.
Okay.
He's a little tiny bandy leg guy. He's a dwarf. He comes from Assyria. He came with the goddess Astarte, who became Nice, we think. And they came, and the Egyptians fell in love with him. He comes, and he teases the pregnant mother and plays with her legs and, you know, makes her laugh and giggle while she's in this terrible pain giving birth. And he makes it better. He makes it easier for her. And then also brings with him Nice. Nice is the weaver of time. In Greece, you have the Furies and the Fates, and they have the fabric of time and the threads of time. And in Egypt, you have Nice, and she does that. She has a shuttle, like for a loom, in her crown. And she, for a long time, they didn't know what that was. And she also has crossed arrows, which are also basically like knitting needles. And she's weaving the fabric of time. And when she cuts your cord, your time is up, just as what happens when the Furies and the Fates do that to the Greeks. They cut that cord, you're back into the next world. Fates, yes. So there's, again, another similarity. You have a goddess. Well, how many goddesses make up the Fates and the Furies?
There's three. In each of them, with the Fates, there's past, present, and future, and with the Furies, which are called Erinyes in Greek, there are three of them. I don't remember the names except for Evriali, and they live in Erebus, which is the in-between place between our living world and the world of the dead.
Well, Nice lives in a temple which is made out of clear crystal. And she has a loom, which is made of gold and alabaster. And she takes gold and silver and copper threads to make the element electrum. And she weaves your soul's destination, its fate, in this electrum piece. And as I say, when she hangs it up on an image of the person, if she cuts the thread, the person's life is ended. But
yes.
She holds in your hand her fate. Your fate is very interesting. And some people, I've read a mythology, I've forgotten the priest's name, but he had a knot in his soul, a knot in his thread of fate. And so he was made immortal. He couldn't die. She couldn't untie that knot. She couldn't break loose. And what happened was he traveled outside of Egypt. He traveled, I believe it was to Madagascar, to the island of Punt, where frankincense trees grow. And he went to go and move something, a jar, a vessel of a particular wine he was told not to drink, and the knot broke. And it's a similar story. I, again, forget who the writer was, but it's, I think it might also be a Greek story, about a man who leaves his city and goes to Damascus. And death is looking for him. And he runs into, he thinks that death is going to find him in Ephesus, because that's where he's from. And, no. And he runs away to Damascus, and he runs into a man who's dark and cold, and he's going to die. And he says to the guy, "You're death, aren't you?" He says, "Yes. I was waiting for you to get here. You were so long in Ephesus, and I was going to meet you in Damascus." So we can't escape our fate.
No, we can't escape. According to the ancient myths, we can't escape our fate, but it's what we do while we're here. And how we
meet
that fate that matters.
Thoth and Tehute are two. Thoth is language and knowledge. Ta is, and they both show as beings, as men, but also Thoth has an Idris head. And sometimes Ta is shown as a baboon or a man with a baboon's head or a man with a gold face and a blue skull cap of lapis lazuli. They often work together, and they're both, if Thoth is knowledge, is masonry and also philosophy. So they work together. They're the educational force. And my point is that they were, in a way, a lot like Athena has a great deal to do with Apollo. And Apollo, in certain ways, is poetry and knowledge. And he needs Athena to help him work with those things, with words. So this is these two as well. They don't work without each other. And when there was a problem and Ra wanted them to create a monster called Sekhmet, which is a lioness who kind of has a great thirst for blood. It's true, Apollo and Athena had the same kind of thing, and I forget the name of the creature that they created, but it was to teach some part of Greece a lesson that they weren't obeying, they were acting bad, and they were going to be destroyed. And it's the same myth. And in the Hebrew traditions, the Jewish traditions, that's what happens because God gets angry and sends angels down to cause a flood. Noah and the whole nine. So all, and Gilgamesh, which is earlier than that, that's in Sumeria. So all these energies are connected. But it was something that, if you look at, there's even something like that in I believe it's the Lakota traditions. I mean, there's a white buffalo and heavy, heavy snows that are going to destroy the people, which is the Lakota people. And so you have all that going on there. And I wondered also, do you think they all spoke to each other? I know that the Greeks and the Egyptians obviously did, but do you think they spoke to perhaps the Chinese, the Indians, Native Americans?
Well, if you allow for lost continents or lost civilizations or ancient aliens or, basically the inner worlds, and communication with the entities that are to be found therein, I suppose it might have been communication. Either that or Jung was right with his collective unconscious theory.
I kind of go with Donovan. Way down in the pit of the ocean, I believe in Atlantis. I do.
I believe in Atlantis, too.
I believe now, there was an amazing continent where they all kind of worked together in commerce. And I don't think it was the first place, but I do think it was a, how will I say it, like a central place where they all came together and they all learned and knowledge. It's like a gigantic university civilization. That's what I look at them as, highly advanced and helping everybody else.
I have similar visions, and we'll have an Atlantis episode so we can discuss those. Unfortunately, we're running out of time again. We only have 3 minutes more to the show, and I'd love people to be able to find you and follow you and get involved with all the great things you're doing.
Okay, let's do that. So find me on Facebook at Michael K. Waterman at Facebook.com. You'll find me, the picture of me, is standing in front of huge butterfly wings, I believe, taken by my late husband, Joseph Alex Martin, who I've missed terribly. You can find me on Instagram with my name, and they'll take you to a username that I have. You can do it at mkwatermancloud.com. You can find me with Hercules. It will direct you to me. And you can find me on my telephone for Phone a Wizard, my work, my tarot, my psychic services, which is 516-650-3691. And otherwise, use a crystal ball, and I'll be right there.
There you go. there will be more episodes of The Major Sages and Seers with Setna, and there will also be more episodes of Sword and Sandal Cinema with Setna, and Setna will still be will soon be appearing on several other of our shows. So I'm looking forward to that, and stay tuned. Setna, again, happy New Year. Always a pleasure speaking with you. Always, you are a storehouse of information, which you share in a very lively and entertaining way. So thank you.
God bless you, and Goddess bless you, Hercules. I am so excited that we've connected. And I love that we have an audience now. They're all excited about working with us all. And you know that we'll be teaching courses soon. And I'm looking forward to a bright, beautiful future.
I'm looking forward to that as well. Thank you very much again. And thank you to all our wonderful audience for tuning in. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called in and you're patiently waiting in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. We will close in the little time we have left with Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin. Or maybe. Thank you, Sedna. Take care.
Oh, you're welcome, guys.
This is the spirit.